ringing of a Tibetan medicine bowl. And the whimpers, although I would like to believe it's from the deep sighs of those whose hearts are being touched in the room, really are coming from our big coonhound dog. But although everyone's heart may be whimpering with great love and joy, I couldn't say it, but not outwardly. So those sounds are something that will come and go through the class, especially Leo, the big coonhound. And we'll also blame him for any snoring that's going on during class. Let the breath fall into a natural swing, but a little bit fuller, a little bit deeper. A little bit higher, a little bit wider. Breathe into every cell, but what's more, allow that breath to fill and nourish all the spaces between the cells. Cell alive and vibrant with light and life, and all the spaces in between open, at ease, relaxed. Breath, let all tension flow out, and freshness and vibrance flow in. So when we breathe out, we release. And when we breathe in, we refresh. So if you will, see the space all around us in all directions, the past, the present, and the future, filled with the luminous, enlightened beings, the various master saints and prophets from all the sacred traditions. We ask them to fill this space with their vibrance, their wisdom, their love, their light. We invoke them to be here with us and in us, participating in each breath, in each moment, guiding us. It's a matter of tuning, because in truth they are always there. Their vibration is in this world, in this universe, radiating out. If we can tune to that vibration, it's like tuning into the Wi-Fi. It's like tuning the channel of a radio. We can tune ourselves. Tune in. Attune. But we have to forget a little bit who we are and who we think we are, to fall into that vibration, allow ourselves to sync up. Up in a receptive mode. For those of us that know the Sufi invocation, let us recite it together. The invocation as given by Hazrat Naikon. Towards the One, the perfection of love, harmony, and beauty, the only being, united with all the illuminated souls who form the embodiment of the Master, the Spirit of Guidance. And imagine that the palms of your hands are being filled with precious blessings from all directions, at all times, by all the holy ones, filled with this golden nectar, this golden light. And take this and allow your hands to rise and pour over your head, over the edges of your body, as a bestowal of blessings. Today's subject is the training of the ego. The training of the ego. What the ego needs and what it does not need. The training of the ego. What the ego needs and what it does not need. and a little quote, and we will do some practices and reflections leading up to the major reading for today, but a quote from the teaching says this: in order to train the ego, it is necessary that one should distinguish what is the right of the ego and what is not its right. In order to train the ego, it is necessary that one should distinguish what is the right of the ego and what is not its right. So again, before we get into this practice, this teaching, I'd like to read the morning prayer that those of us that are initiates or inquirers do daily, I hope, but if not, then that's your choice. I was reading yesterday a paper, an esoteric paper that speaks about these prayers, and it was in the words of Hazrat Anay Khan, a teaching that he gave to the Sharads or the lamp bearers, the ones that had been initiated to officiate the Universal Worship Service. And he was very clear, and he's made very few demands, but he did say, please do not edit one word of these prayers. They are not from the human mind. They are from someplace else. And he said that everyone felt that it was their right to change this word or that word that did not please them, that in the end, what would be left of the original vibration? And he also said that these prayers alone are the very practice that can lead to every awakening, to illumination, to happiness. And yet, believe it or not, I have people say to me, I don't like the prayers, I don't want to say prayers. And I say, okay, it's not my doing, I'm not there whipping you to do those prayers. But if an icon says there's this incredible blessing and we're on this path, then one would think that we would listen to those words of his. And so this is the morning prayer, and I'm reading it because I'm really trying to get to this last line where we can use it as a practice. This is the prayer called Psalm. Praise be to thee, most supreme God, omnipotent, omnipresent, all-pervading, the only being. Take us in thy parental arms. Raise us from the denseness of the earth. Thy beauty do we worship, and to thee do we give willing surrender. Most merciful and compassionate God, the idealized Lord of the whole humanity, thee only do we worship, and to thee alone do we aspire. Open our hearts towards thy beauty. Illuminate our souls with divine light. O thou, the perfection of love, harmony, and beauty, all-powerful, creator, sustainer, judge, and forgiver of our shortcomings, Lord God of the East and of the West, of the worlds above and below, and of the seen and the unseen beings, pour upon us thy light. Pour upon us thy love and thy light. gives sustenance to our bodies, hearts, and souls. Use us for the purpose that thy wisdom chooseth, and guide us on the path of thine own goodness. Draw us closer to thee every moment of our life, until in us be reflected thy grace, thy glory, thy wisdom, thy joy, and thy peace. Amen. Draw us closer to thee every moment of our life, until in us be reflected thy grace, thy glory, thy wisdom, thy joy, and thy peace. These five qualities are at the end of this prayer. Until in us be reflected these five divine qualities. Now let's talk for a moment about five. Murshid had a great affinity for the number five, so much so that he was born on the 5th and he died on the 5th.
July 5th.
July 5th, he was born, and he passed on February 5th. He also gives us these five divine qualities. He also talks about the elemental world of five elements. These are not unrelated. They are very much related in his cosmology, in the cosmology. And so I'd like for us to involve ourselves in the elemental breaths a little bit differently than we've done them in the past, because these breaths, of course, can be used in a number of ways. These practices are not static. They're not static. They're living. They're living, and they're created and given to us as this body of teachings to awaken something in us to make it living and not predictable. So, this practice of the five divine qualities and the five elements. If you will, we'll begin the breath of earth. The breath is in the nose and out the nose in a spreading direction. Vakila, there are chairs, hon. Are you okay?
Yeah,
because there are chairs in the back. So the breath is in the nose and out the nose. The emphasis is on this exhalation spreading. And think about, as you breathe in, and most especially as you breathe out, this idea of thy grace, grace, grace. You see, Murshid's always telling us, he's teaching us this moral culture. It's one of the most significant things that he's given us. It wasn't a religion, it's a social movement. It's an inner social movement, an inner moral movement, code of conduct that then manifests itself as part of our society, as part of our culture. But that grace, you think about the great nobility. He talks about we must try to gain democracy of the personality while expressing the nobility of our soul and this idea of grace. In fact, in the great courts, they used to call the noble people my grace. This idea of a kind of surrender, of putting it down. A great haiku that's inspired me for 30 years says this: the grasses fall, they lay as they fall. Don't try to rearrange themselves to fix everything, to move everything in the universe around them. There's no narcissism there. It's all, it is as it is. And so, thy grace. So breathing in and exhaling, releasing thy grace, this feeling of divine grace flowing through us, spreading out. Spreading in all directions, thy grace. Element Earth, thy grace. The next breath is the breath of the element of water. And this breath is breathing in the nose and out the mouth. In the nose and out the mouth. Thy glory. Thy glory. I think of it. I don't know. Is it Yosemite? There's a park where they have the fountain. Old Glory. Isn't there a huge geyser or geyser that comes up? You see, the Yellowstone. The point is being this rising up from the earth, like this water pushing up, and we can think of drawing that up through our bodies as we breathe in and as we breathe out. It descends like a huge fountain of thy glory. So breathing in, feel the rising as we breathe in, and then as we breathe out through the nose, the descent. This blessing of the water element, but the gracefulness of the water element. Again, it's not sclerosed, it's not fixated, it's flowing by glory. In the nose and out the mouth, by glory. breath changes, and it is transformed into the fire element. And the breath is in the mouth and out the nose. In the mouth and out the nose. Now the direction is completely vertical, but in a rising motion, where before water descended, now we're moving upward. Believe me, if you can understand these breaths, what you cannot understand becomes completely comprehensible, because it's all about these directions and these subtle vibrations. If you can move this energy in your own body, this is how the great mystics were able to transform matter for the purpose of healing, for feeding the hungry, for creating balance and harmony and peace. These are not just silly little things that Mershiv gave to us. They're great mysteries that, when practiced, can benefit oneself and all of humanity, your loved ones, those you care about. They can bring about prosperity. They can destroy illness. They can attract everything you want and repel everything you don't want. So the breath, again, is in the mouth and out the nose, and thy wisdom, that illuminating presence of light, the result of fire, and the transformative ability. This is what the alchemists understood. Putting ordinary metal into a flame, it could be transformed into gold. And the Sufis embrace this metaphor, because this is what we must do. We must thrust that part of the ego which holds us back onto this sacred fire, so that the gold, the dross can burn away and the gold can emerge. Thy wisdom. In the mouth, out the nose, feeling the illuminating quality of light, of wisdom, and the transformative aspect of fire. In the mouth, out the nose. The breath is transforming into a more subtle element, the air element, and the breath is in the mouth and out the mouth, in the mouth and out the mouth. And in the directions or the instructions of Hazar Nikon, he talks about the motion being like a zigzag motion. One might think of it like a DNA molecule, the way things move back and forth, or the energy up the spine, the kundalini. So this is the air element, and thy joy. That perhaps you've been in a quiet place and all of a sudden you hear the beautiful noise of a, or the sound of a flute playing in the air, this beautiful joy that arises in one's heart, in one's mind. Thy joy. Thy joy, the air element. The breath again is in the mouth and out the mouth. Last element, thy peace. And the breath now is through the nose and out through the nose again, but it is so subtle. The breath becomes nearly imperceptible. It's like as if one is being breathed from the inside out. Thy peace. Thank you. also just to reflect for a moment on the motions or the directions that Murshid has indicated with the elements, keep in mind that it is also making the sign of the cross over us. Horizontal motion, the vertical motion, and then the bestowal of blessing. You see, there is nothing that can be taken for granted. There is such immense subtlety and vast amount of wisdom in these teachings. And he talks about the significance of this motion. He says it's a very essential blessing and protection that we give to each other. And he gives us form in the outward zikr, but now he's teaching us in a very subtle way of doing that with the breath and making that horizontal line, spreading in all directions, drawing the line of limitation, acknowledging that this world is a world of limitation, but then the vertical line, the unlimited, comes in. The eminent, the transcendent. It's all there. It's very subtle. But one practices and one then begins to know. It shouldn't be understood just from my words. It should be understood from one's experience by doing this practice. I don't expect anyone to believe me, or even to believe Murshid. One has to know for oneself. Now here we go with the number 5 again. This is a teaching, a small excerpt from a larger teaching on philosophy. I'm reading from The Flower Garden of Anayat Khan. And he says, philosophy, which is the fourth stage of development, has 5 aspects. The physical, the intellectual, the mental, the moral, and the spiritual. We could make an association with those elements again, or those qualities to the elements, the physical, the intellectual, the mental, the moral, and the spiritual. Very important what he's about to say. These cannot be learned by the mere perusal of books and by listening to the discussions of philosophers. These cannot be learned by the mere perusal of books and by the listening to the discussions of philosophers. For philosophy is not a study which is taught in universities alone. It contains quite an opposite path to knowledge, and it can only be studied under the guidance of a Murshid. In him, the Murid has perfect trust and confidence, as complete discipline at the sacrifice of free will is required. At first this appears to be a loss of individuality, while the ego rebels at being thus crushed and submerged beneath the strong laws of will and reason. But the battle against the self gives a mastery over self in the end, which, in other words, is a mastery over the whole universe. But the battle against self gives a mastery over self in the end, which, in other words, is a mastery over the whole universe. But it is well to remember that such utter trust should never be reposed in a Murshid until the self has gained entire confidence in him, and every doubt has to be subdued. When once this confidence is given, there should be nothing on earth which could break or cast it down for the whole gamut of eternity. There are some You consider it most humiliating to be guided by another, but they're greatly mistaken. For in the light of truth, there is but one. The intercourse between Murshid and Murid is preferable to any other fellowship in the world, and one considers that a friendship in God is the only true friendship which endureth forever. And then you can look at this after the class, but there's a beautiful painting here of Murshid. This is an apricot tree that's on the land adjoining where he lived in France. And this tree is where he met with his students and he gave initiations. Teacher can do something quite startling on the path. My friend Pierre Chabot-Cohn was telling me, and I think he's told others this, that when he went the first time to meet with Murshid Samuel Lewis, Murshid Sam opened the door and took him into a room where he met with people, and he said to Chabot, he said, his name was Peter then, by the way. Why are you here? And he said, I don't really have anything to ask or say. I just wanted to come see you. And Murshid Sam said, thank you for coming then. And he got up and he walked out. He saw him. I mean, why should he take up the time of this person that has a great deal of responsibility just to please his own fancy? And that was the first lesson that Murshid Sam gave to him. You understand? A very good lesson. And Joe and I were talking this morning. I think he was asking me some questions about my Murshida Vera, who was my first initiator and guide. And some maybe know and some maybe don't know. Most don't know. She gave me a practice that most Murshids said they would never give to a student because it could break them. It's a practice that's given in Arabic to humiliate. Can you imagine being given a practice and consciously taking it up to be humiliated? Here Vilayat said, I'd never give that practice to someone without the balancing wazifa. It could break someone. And yet, for years, I did that practice because I trusted her. And I went through one humiliation after another, publicly, privately, everything. My mom knows what I've gone through. But you know what? Even so much so that my Murshida totally humiliated me at a leader's camp by yelling at me on the night of a high mountain where everyone could hear for hours. And then later people said, you shouldn't take that, that's abuse. And I said, she's my teacher, she knows what she's doing. Don't criticize her. She loves me very much. You see how easy it would have been to jump on that boat and say, she's a bad person, I'm right. No, you don't do that if you really are a dedicated person. You take the lens and you turn it to see what the benefit is. One can do this with one's own life because one's own life gives enough humiliations, am I correct? But what's the benefit? What's the triumph in the end when one overcomes those or deals with them directly?
You grow up and evolve.
It wasn't a question. This is a rhetorical question. one can think about that within themselves. So this is a very important teaching that we're entering into about the ego. One has to ask oneself about that. But in the end, my Murshida gave me so much strength and courage. She wasn't raising a wimp. She wasn't telling me you're doing great all the time. And God is my witness, and Joe and Cabrilla also know this. Whenever I've met with my teachers, I always say to them, I love you, I will do anything you say, and please, the best thing you can do is not to tell me what I'm doing right, but to tell me what you see me doing wrong. That's how I learn. Not someone to, well, you're such a good person. So I don't care about that. That's not true friendship either, to tell you the truth. Now, on the other hand, one should always defend the one that's not present. If there's talking, this is well learned, also community-wise, not to participate in things and to just be loving and kind. And if there's not someone there to defend themselves, you see the good and you reflect that bad. Does that make sense? I've encountered this at this college where the students want to talk. And then I take them all together and I said, when someone's not there to defend themselves, you defend them. I hope that this is making sense to people. Does it?
Yes.